I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back for another one of our Sunday live streams. Our guest in the first hour is Kievsky. Kievsky has written for Countercurrents going back way back to like 2011. He's also done a number of podcasts with us over the years that have always been well received. And I always say when I do these interviews, let's do this again soon. So I'm making good on this. And we are going to talk today about, I guess, some life hacks, if you will, and really how to make the best of a bad situation, namely the ongoing crisis of American civilization. So, Kievsky, welcome back.
Thank you for having me on, Greg.
Well, so how is the pandemic treating you?
It's treating me quite well, considering that I've been preparing for it for 20 years, and most people like us have been preparing for the pandemic, you know, and so it didn't come as any surprise. And, you know, we were not caught psychologically or materially unprepared. We were ready.
Yeah, this is really true. A lot of the people I know, and I've been in this movement for close to 20 years, or more than 20 years, really. I know more people who are prepping than, you know, in any other subculture. I guess there's like a proper prepper subculture, but a lot of people are thinking about collapses and thinking about anti-fragility, thinking about protecting assets, thinking about how this thing can unwind, because we all believe that American civilization today is unsustainable. And if something's unsustainable, it means the wheels are going to come off sometime. And it could be a pandemic. It could be an economic crisis. It could be insurrection in the streets. As it turns out, it's all three right now.
Yes. And, you know, I have not yet seen an article from the left. And I read them obsessively, The Atlantic, New York Times, Slate.com. I have not yet seen an article about the fact that right wingers are more prepared than they are. And we're probably going to come out on the other side of this thing stronger, much stronger than we have been, and stronger, you know, and more having more leverage than they do and more ability to get things we want. And they will have less ability to get things they want. And this is going to have like world historical implications.
What are some of the ways that you think we're better leveraged to benefit from this situation?
Well, we're prepared. I mean, we've got food. We have we're survivalists. We have assets that aren't tied to fiat currency. We've studied the history of the Rothschilds and how to invest when there's blood in the streets, and we've been waiting to invest in the blood in the streets, and that's pretty much here. So we're going to actually buy distressed real estate and get it commercial and residential and build white communities from these distressed real estate. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, that is one factor, definitely. That's one opportunity. We're talking about fiat currency, and yeah, there are two kinds of anti-fiat currency people that I know. On the right, one are the gold bugs, as we like to call them, and the other are the Bitcoin lovers. And Bitcoin is a strange sort of thing because it's all made up. It's totally fiat in a sense, but there's a limited amount of it, and therefore it's not something that can be arbitrarily inflated into worthlessness. And the current crisis is treating gold holders and Bitcoin holders really quite well. So that's definitely one example of how this ongoing crisis is really making the right a little bit more powerful, at least in the sense that we've got more money. And in this Senate, in this system, money means power.
You know, something else, one of my ongoing themes is the revolution will not be televised. And that is really true. The right has a high trust network. We're pretty good at like you get your dysfunctional people here and there, but that's really those are the people you see. And for every one of those dysfunctionals, there's thousands of people who aren't, who keep their word, who don't rip each other off. And so we have a high trust network already. And I'm, as a businessman, my company, I saw how to do a high trust network in Microcosm, and I competed with low trust companies and did very well against them. And so now I'm ready to scale this up. What I see coming is that we're going to have companies that are owned and operated by right wingers, and the bosses and owners of those companies are not going to take excessive profits to themselves. They're gonna pay the people doing the work a fair wage, you know, and provide them with housing and help them save up and have some financial security. You know, we're gonna focus on financial security for everybody rather than mansions and fancy cars for, you know, the few at the top. And that's because, you know, we're going to be a high trust network, and we want to save the white race. That our motive is not, you know, another vacation home, another Gulfstream jet. Our motive is to save the white race. And we're going to do that through business and real estate property management.
Yeah, I do think that one of the factors that's going to contribute to the, I think there will be a crash in the value of urban real estate. And there are really two factors that are contributing to that. One is that COVID, of course, is causing a collapse in tourism. And a collapse in tourism means a collapse in Airbnb. And there are a lot of people who went all in with Airbnb, took out lots of mortgages to buy apartments and fix them up. And there were these super hosts. Now those people are in big trouble. I think a lot of their properties are going to be auctioned off eventually. They're going to go into default. These properties are going to collapse in value. They will be things that you can pick up cheap. And then the other factor is specifically in the United States is that, well, cities are crazy now. Cities are abolishing the police force. Cities are running rampant with Black Lives Matter and anarchist types, and they are ruled by mayors and city councils that want to give these people room to destroy, right? And I think that one factor that's sort of preventing these places from completely collapsing right now is that unless you're extremely wealthy, it's very difficult to move given the COVID lockdowns and the COVID problems, the massive unemployment and so forth. But as soon as the COVID stuff stops holding things in place, I think we're going to see a huge departure from major metropolitan areas. The more liberal, the more people leaving.
Well, it's already happening. I mean, did you see Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York City begging the rich to come back to New York City?
Yeah, I did see that. And, you know, the rich can do this anytime. You know, they got the money. They can just say, okay, we're leaving and we're doing it now. The middle class, the upper middle class, they're more stuck, I think. But even those people are going to be leaving. And that means that, you know, real estate prices, I think, are going to start going down in a lot of these major metropolitan areas. And I do think that's going to provide opportunities for race-conscious white people who have been stacking and holding their Bitcoin and stacking and holding their gold and watching those assets go up to come in and buy things that I think in the long term they probably will appreciate in value. We might need to have a revolution before they do, but sometimes, you know, I think it's still an opportunity, definitely.
Yeah, I've told you my dream. Way back in 1995, I spent six months in Russia, and I saw how much better educated Russian kids were. When they would learn violin, it would be really good at it, or piano, or gymnastics. Whereas in America, the kids, you know, they might play violin, but they're like dilettantes. You know, they play out of tune and scratchy, and they don't get that good. Whereas like an 11-year-old from Russia could sign up for an American symphony orchestra, could audition and probably get in. I mean, they're that well-trained. And one of the reasons that American kids don't get that good at stuff is because we're locked out of our cities. The cities are too expensive to live in for middle-class white Americans. So we're exiled to the burbs. So my dream is to have kind of two places. You know, you have the homeschooling families have the country home out in New Hampshire or Vermont, and then the city, the apartments in the city in Boston. And in the week, during the week, come to the city and take advantage of the educational opportunities, learning foreign languages, learning to play the piano, gymnastics, dance, all that kind of culture stuff. And then on the weekends, you know, go back to the home, to the farm in New Hampshire and you know, and live the country life. That's what we're I think that's the plan. And such children will grow up much more well-rounded and be way above, you know, now, because the kids nowadays are so dumbed down. It's just, it's frightening. And so children from white nationalist homeschooling families will just be miles above the average, and therefore get into, you know, get into the alphabet agencies, get into the government, get into corporations, and take over from within. And that's the plan.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it. We do take donations while we're doing these live streams. It's not just a way of raising consciousness, but also a way of getting donations for Countercurrents. So I want to just take a quick look at the Entropy channel. If you wish to donate to help out, you can go to entropystream.live/countercurrents, entropystream.live/countercurrents, and simply make a donation, leave a comment, leave a question. We'll read them out loud. There are just a couple here to start with, so let me run through those quickly. Daniel sends $25. Thank you very much. I should also mention that right now we are wrapping up a very generous matching grant. We got a 20,000 euro matching grant, and we are almost to the end of it. But I can very confidently say that any donations made during this podcast will be doubled. So thank you for your $25, Daniel. That'll be $50. Alex gives 20 euros. Thank you very much with the message, keep on going. Thank you. Mr. James writes in with $25. No comment, but thank you very much for that. And now I want to look over at our DLive stream. Gadius Maximus says, good afternoon, gents. And he also says a shout out to Carl Thorburn. Carl Thorburn, who's at Carl K, Carl with a K, Thorburn, on Twitter, is one of my favorite people on Twitter. And he is a Bitcoin maven, a Bitcoin maximalist. So I guess that's why Gadius is pointing him out. He's definitely somebody to follow if you're interested in that particular investment tool.
I recommend everyone to go on YouTube and watch the movie. It was made by the Third Reich called Die Rothschilds Aktien auf Waterloo, or Stocks in Waterloo. And I've been fascinated by the Rothschilds for a long time. They liberated their people through, you know, by manipulating the financial system. And instead of just taking the money and being rich, they spent it on their own people. And we can and should do the same thing. I think we can liberate ourselves that way, you know, not really, not the old Turner Diaries, you know, hot lead and cold steel way, you know, that worked in the Middle Ages. But now it's all about manipulation and money and social cohesiveness. And I really urge you to study the history of the Rothschilds in the Napoleonic era, particularly. So briefly, what happened was Mayor Amschel Rothschild traded gold coins with the Elector of Hesse Cassel. And as he said about in the movie, you'll see, he says to his son, erwächst mit Menschen, about the Elector of Hesse Cassel. He trades in men. Without blood, there is no profit. And, you know, that. So the Elector got rich by selling mercenaries to fight for King George in the American War of Independence. And then this is a true story. So the the elector had to flee Prussia, modern day Germany, to Denmark. And he was afraid to take his money with him, his gold and silver, because he was afraid he'd be robbed on the way. It's funny, like a guy who sold mercenaries is afraid for his own security and flees Napoleon. But that was the story. So he hid it with Rothschild, with Mayor Amschel Rothschild, in the Judengasse, of the Jewish quarter of Frankfurt. And Mayor Amschel Rothschild sent his five sons to the five capitals of Europe. And the oldest son went to London. And so he sent 600,000 pounds to Nathan and said, invest in England. And he invested it. He made friends with Herries, the finance minister of England, and became the, you know, bid for the lowest interest for the war bonds, what they were called, consols at the time. And he beat out Baring, who was the famous English banker. And once he got it going, he told the rest of the Jews in Europe, look, I have this, I have this 1% interest VIG you can get. And so he got all the Jews of Europe to give him money to lend to the British government for, you know, 4%. And he would skim off 1% and give the other 3% to the people who lent the money. So they got very wealthy, and he used his ethnic community to do that. He, you know, the 600,000 was just, that was the first stake. But after that, he used the rest of the Jews in Europe because they had a hard time finding reliable borrowers. You know, a lot of borrowers would default, and a government is the most reliable borrower you can get. You're guaranteed to pay it back. And then he had very fast communication compared to everyone else. They used passenger pigeons and horseback messengers. And he found out before everyone else that Wellington had defeated Napoleon at Waterloo. This was after Napoleon had escaped the island on Elba and, you know, had 100 days war. And so Wellington defeated Napoleon at Waterloo. Nathan Rothschild found out first, went to the stock market, the English stock market, and sold everything and made everyone panic, and everybody else sold everything. And then he bought back, and then they all found out that Wellington defeated Napoleon, and the English stock market went way up. And that's how they really, their fortune went up, I think, 20-fold. So that's how they became very wealthy. And, you know, they invested it in their own people and in getting their own people emancipated. To be a peer in the House of Lords, you had to say on the oath of a good Christian. And Benjamin Disraeli, who actually was a prime minister of England, he was ethnically Jewish, racially Jewish, but he converted to Catholicism. And he, you know, and when he became a peer, he said the oath and everything, but he was friends with Nathan, but he was kind of the sellout one. And Nathan's like, well, we're going to get our people to say on to become a peer without saying the oath of a good Christian. And this is 1848. So Lionel Rothschild, Nathan's son, became a peer without having to say on the oath of a good Christian. And I see the analogy as, you know, us being allowed to be white. We're going to make it okay to be white again. And that is our version of removing the, you know, removing, we have legal and financial disabilities on us. You know, we get kicked off of PayPal and deplatformed from YouTube. So our situation, ironically, is quite analogous to the restrictions put upon Jews in the medieval era and the modern era up until the 1800s. And, you know, we can liberate ourselves the same way by becoming wealthy enough and using our own high trust, leveraging our own high trust and motivated ethnic network to push the government and the legal systems to stop hurting us so much and stop disabling us and denying us social capital and stop white genocide. So one of my favorite sayings from the Rothschild is, invest when there's blood in the streets, even if that blood is your own. And that applies to us because, I mean, white genocide is our blood in the streets. And there's a lot of people who are black-pilled about white genocide. But this is exactly the time to invest. And when I say invest, I mean to invest in yourself, in learning skills, and, you know, in learning things, because so many people are dumbed down and on drugs and stuff, that if you learn STEM, if you learn math and engineering, there will be well-paid jobs for you. And, you know, like utility companies and defense contractors, you'll have to pass a drug test. So if you smoke weed, you'll have to quit that shit. And, but because so many people smoke weed, you know, they're desperate to hire people who don't use drugs and who, you know some engineering and know some math. So this is precisely the time to invest. The blood in the streets is here.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at this. I mean, one of the things that's going on with the dominance of the left, the dominance of the left is basically involved with debauching all of our standards. That's how they create their coalition, right? The left is a coalition of people who feel bad about themselves because we have standards, and we have standards by which they feel bad. So we have educational standards. We have grammar. We have math. They're even attacking mathematics and grammar now as racist. And it's true. The rules of math are racist because, well, when you actually count things like IQs and make predictions based on it, it just turns out that all kinds of negative stereotypes are well-founded. Grammar is racist because if you speak grammatical, right, people judge you as more intelligent than if you babble ungrammatically. So the left's whole coalition is basically, one of the great terms that's been used recently is bio-Leninism. It's basically a coalition of the biologically ill-favored and botched and inferior who feel bad. And they don't just want to be treated kindly, right? They don't want to be just treated kindly, but looked down upon as poor, pathetic people who need a handout. They want to overthrow the entire system of norms and values in terms of which they are judged to be lacking. And so what this requires is the destruction of standards in education. And just focus on educational standards. If you destroy educational standards, you're going to find that the educational system produces fewer and fewer competent people each year. Yet at the same time, we are locked into a technological system that requires more and more intelligent people every year to make the system work and to make it prosper, to make it progress. And so there's definitely an internal contradiction in contemporary society between the requirements of technology, which requires better education and higher IQs if we're going to continue having progress, and the bio-Leninist left, which is all about debauching standards. And we're coming to a point where people are just desperate to find college graduates who can write and read. The very idea that college graduates might come out without being able to write very well or read very well is absurd, but that's the kind of clown country we live in. And so one of the things that I've enjoyed about your writing over the years and the podcasts we've done is you've just emphasized that if you are competent in things like math, in things like writing, in things like reading, basic skills, especially STEM skills, the fact is that even though there's going to be all kinds of discrimination against whites, and it is real, there is still going to be such a terrible demand for people who can actually keep the oligarchs' helicopters flying, right? Keep the big line going up, and all these things that we are going to be able to leverage social decline in the favor of our community if we just invest in our own education and our own self-improvement, and especially our children too.
Yeah, and self-teaching works really well. so much better than a teacher, because it's self-paced, and when you're forced to figure things out yourself, then you learn more permanently than when some teacher shows you how to do it. I mean, I spend 2 or 3 hours a day studying math and electrical engineering and planning to go back to UConn for it. And I used to use a tutor years ago, and he called me a few months ago, said, "What, did you quit?" I said, "No, I just don't need you anymore. I can figure everything out myself." And I don't really anticipate needing a teacher. I'm doing linear algebra and probability and counting right now, and electronics. And it's fine. I can figure it out myself. And by the way, if anybody else wants to be a self-teacher, you can leave my email address up on the show site, because I'm willing to help people teach themselves. Sure. But one of the things that happened when we got kicked off the internet is, and I predicted this was going to happen years ago, is we started meeting up in person, just informally, just as friends, you know? And I've noticed that white nationalists are extremely well-educated. That, you take an inventory of the people you're hanging out with, and you realize this could be a college faculty right here, including graduate school, like professional school, like medical school, law school, STEM, history, several foreign languages are represented. So one of the famous anecdotes about Adolf Hitler is that he became the Führer because he was rejected from art school in Vienna. And the white nationalist movement is at least tens of thousands of people who got rejected from their own version of art school and had to make their own way. And they didn't give up and black pill and become addicts. They went on and you know, they might have a job doing whatever, working at a fast food restaurant, but they're still studying Latin, still reading biblical Hebrew, you know, to read the Bible in the original or something. I mean, all these crazy things that people know, it just, you would, you know, and they'll just talk, get to, you know, we get together and talk about things. I mean, I don't have the endurance to stay up till 2 in the morning, but a lot of them do. And just really interesting, intelligent conversations. You would never, you know, if you took a random sampling of people from the street, you would not get it. It's such an eclectic group. I mean, white nationalism really selects for the smartest, most ambitious people in the country. They don't realize how dangerous they, you know, kicking us out off the internet, kicking us out of the universities, not letting us be professors, not letting us be, you know, a bunch of things. That was just very dangerous, because now, you know, we're all feral now. We're all in the wild. We don't need professors or teachers. We teach ourselves.
Mm-hmm. You know, back in 2016, I knew a lot of people in the movement, and a lot of these people I knew just through their funny screen names and things like that. But then I started meeting people in person, and I started actually getting to know these people under their real name. And I got to look at some resumes of people, I mean, where they actually laid out their CVs. And I have to say, I was blown away by the intelligence, the educational achievements, the language skills and stuff like that of a lot of people who are attracted to our cause. There are some truly remarkable people. There were people that, you know, I thought were bright and everything, but I was really taken aback by just how accomplished they were. And yeah, a lot of these people have good places in the system. Of course, they have to keep their noses clean and things like that. But we really are attracting very good quality people. And one thing that's cracking me up is Andy Goh. I don't know how it's pronounced, NGO. He is this Vietnamese-descended reporter who covers the Antifa beat. He's a free speech advocate, obviously, and he's a law advocate, obviously. And he's out in Portland, and he's also covering Antifa violence all over the country. And he's putting up the mugshots and arrest records of these people who are being arrested in these Antifa riots that have been happening for more than 2 months now. And these are not the most accomplished people at all. A lot of them are clearly drug addicts. A huge number of them are transsexuals. It's quite amazing the percentage of these people who are transsexuals. You just look at these vacant or hate-filled or goofy faces. The left does not attract the best. It does not attract the brightest anymore. It does not attract real intellectuals who lust after intellectual excitement. All of that excitement is migrated to the right. So let me look quickly at our entropy. There's a question here from Gadius Maximus, who's donated $20. What is the point of cities in the modern era? With instant communication and front porch delivery, shouldn't cities be obsolete? What do you think of that?
Well, I think that you still need stuff like in-person piano lessons, dance lessons, martial arts, voice lessons, you know, art, that kind of stuff. I mean, that's what I want the city for. I want to see American white kids grow up being able to play the piano as good as like the Russian kids at the Moscow Conservatory, or dance as well as the Russians at the Bolshoi Ballet. You know, I wanted to see white kids that can speak, you know, four languages. Although that you could get that probably from home, but that this is what a city is good for. And, you know, people don't realize that, but this is what American kids really are missing. We're all dilettantes here. We don't get as good at things as the Chinese and the Russians do. And I want you to feel really deprived. I want you to feel like, wow, we're missing out, you know, fear of missing out. You're missing out on Moscow Conservatory levels of piano playing and guitar playing and cello playing. You know, you're missing out on Bolshoi Ballet levels of, you know, dance, being able to dance and stuff. That's what cities are for, in my opinion.
I would agree with that completely. One of the things that cities make possible is enough people to have a symphony orchestra or a university faculty. You need a certain large number of people before you're going to have enough of the small numbers of people who can do those sorts of things, like be professors, be classical musicians, things like that. There might be one of these people in 20,000. So if you're going to have an orchestra of 100 people, you're going to need 100 times 20,000 people in your metro area before you've got the population where something like that can really gel. And a lot of culture creation requires face-to-face interaction, face-to-face meetings, rehearsals, people inspiring one another, people building real relationships. Now, a lot of commercial activity doesn't require that, especially if it's like lower level commercial activity. But even in commerce, even in business, at the top of things, people insist on being able to meet face to face. We are run by elites that make decisions in private clubs, over dinners, at weekend retreats and things like that, where they can speak face to face with one another. They want all of us to be separated, isolated in our own little cubicles, our little apartments, or in our own suburban households, connected to the world through wires and information beamed at us, preferably information completely under the control of the elites. And of course, the modern internet and social media has disrupted that tremendously, and they're trying to regain control. That a lot of power slipped out of their hands. The days where there were three American TV networks, so you could basically control from a central point everything that people watched on television, those days are gone. The days when there are one or two giant news services basically broadcasting out everything that you read in the newspaper, so everybody's on the same page, those days are gone because of the internet. They want to get that back. But the point is that cities exist because the highest level decisions in a society And the highest level creative activities in a society take place face-to-face, and that requires a certain critical mass of people before you find enough people to be those creative or governing elites. So, yeah, urban life has become hellish in America and Great Britain and other places in Western Europe because of non-white immigration and non-white integration and riots and crime, et cetera, et cetera. And we're missing out on that. One of the things that's happened is the extremely wealthy elites, they can live in cities in bubbles and pretty much insulate themselves from urban pathologies. But they look upon, you know, the colonization of big cities by non-whites as a way of pushing down and pushing out their white rivals, their would-be white rivals. The rising white middle class or upper middle class, these are the people who are vulnerable, and these are the people who flee, and these are the people who lose all the opportunities that cities grant, opportunities that would allow them to challenge the existing elites.
Yeah, I always found it shocking that I couldn't afford to live in Boston, but there's a lot of people living in Boston who don't work a day in their life. You know, I mean, that's crazy. How you and I can't afford to live there at all. I should get that freebie, you know, deal. Cause then, you know, I would actually take advantage of the city. I would have taken my daughter to gymnastics and dance and music lessons, you know, and these people live in there for free. They don't patronize those things. Even if that stuff is offered to them for free, they don't bother. I mean, they might as well, they could live anywhere and they would do exactly the same things. You know, why are you giving them prime real estate a mile from downtown Boston? I will never understand that, unless it's just malicious against us. You know, it's just to spite us, I suppose. But that shocks me.
I honestly think that that is a huge motive. The fact, okay, when you go to a modern museum and you see a big painting hanging on the wall that looks like it could be done by a child and, you know, put on the front of your refrigerator with a couple of banana-shaped magnets, right? But this is on the wall in galleries and it's being praised and it's being sold for millions of dollars, et cetera, et cetera. That serves two purposes. One, it debauches the standards of society, and it's part of the sort of cultural Bolshevist putsch. But the other reason why they do that is simply to keep a good white artist who actually can paint and sculpt and do stuff of real aesthetic value, to keep them off the walls of the galleries, out of the museums, and so forth. So a lot of the garbage that's promoted is simply promoted to fill up gaps that could be basically filled by talented people of the group that are being slated for destruction. And that's whites in white countries, actual white people. And so, you know, that's why a lot of this cultural Bolshevism exists. And that's why you have, you know, extremely valuable real estate within walking distance of great museums and great symphony halls and great cultural institutions being colonized by people with low IQs and no taste and who have absolutely no interest in these things. It's to keep the white kids away, to keep the native white population away from these things, to prevent them from basically carrying forward their culture and also having access to upward mobility.
That's breathtakingly malicious. That's just so horrifying to even think about. But, you know, something that strikes me, we don't even realize it anymore, how much the foot is on our neck. And, you know, oh, you're blaming others for your problems. Yeah, because they really are doing stuff to hold us down. The threat of that is that it's like holding a cork underwater. You know, the minute things let go, we'll go flying up above the water level. And, but there's some things have happened that I've noticed. The Antifa, Andy goes Antifas, a lot of them are school teachers and college professors, and the school teachers are saying we don't want to reopen the schools. You know, we want to get paid and not go back to school. And I'm unironically agree. Don't reopen the schools, please. And it's one of those things that by the time they say, okay, we want to reopen the schools now, you know, a year or two from now, we'll have gotten used to not paying for the schools. You know, we won't have the property tax money to pay for that project anymore. So I think if they don't reopen the schools this year, they might never reopen them. And the other thing I saw that I unironically agree with, Mary Elizabeth Williams on Salon.com wrote an article about modern day colleges saying that they suck. They're not worth it. They're too expensive. And I unironically agree. I mean, get rid of, so many of those colleges that are just ruining young people and turning them into Marxists and feminists. You know, all those pictures of those girls that look normal, you know, when they're senior in high school, and then after a year of college, their hair is green and they're obese and they got all kinds of piercings and stuff. Now, you know, Mary Elizabeth Williams and I both agree, get rid of those colleges. That will be great. So, you know, the left is they're destroying their own institutions. I love COVID-19. It's the best thing that's ever happened to us.
Yeah, I have to agree. It's going to be very interesting. The tens of millions of people, women who are unemployed from their pink collar jobs, not able to send their two children back to school in the fall, they might actually kind of get used to, and they might actually kind of like having, you know, staying at home and raising their kids and maybe cooking meals for them. People who don't have money anymore to do fast food and take out all the time are now discovering, well, you know, they can actually cook and they can learn how to cook better. There's a certain force for more traditional, natural, and healthy forms of living that are sort of built into the effects of this COVID thing. I mean, it's the economic consequences are fairly catastrophic. Don't get me wrong, but there are a few bright points about this. Yeah, if schools don't reopen in the fall, why do we even pay school teachers anymore? There's going to be a huge pressure to just let these people go, lay them all off. I mean, if people in the private sector are being laid off and losing their jobs, then why not lay off a lot of these blue-haired harpies and gender bender, mind twister freaks who run the educational system? And yeah, I would like to see a lot of colleges fail. A very large number of American colleges are very precarious. They're extremely expensive. They give substandard, crappy educations. And if everything ends up being online and you can just, you can crash Harvard Zoom lectures all you want, I think that a lot of these schools will end up failing. So these are great opportunities. And the number one predictor for shit lib behavior and shit lib beliefs is a college education, especially in the liberal arts. The fewer people who go to these institutions, the better, which is one reason why, just like with abortion, student loan reform is like a low priority thing for me. I kind of want college education to continue to spiral into the stratosphere in terms of costs, because I want to make it harder and harder for people to go to these things. And the ones who go through it and come out with the liberal arts degrees and the blue hair and the hateful ideas, I want them to live under a crushing burden of debt for the rest of their lives. That's not a bad outcome.
They're not going to be able to do student loan reform. I mean, the presidents and deans of these colleges don't want to take a huge pay cut. The reason college is so expensive is because student loans are guaranteed by the government. The minute you guarantee loans by the government, then the prices of something will go up. Same reason houses are so expensive is because of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac guaranteeing loans for houses. So as long as the government stops subsidizing student loans, they'll have to drastically cut tuition and cut their budgets, you know, and strip down to the bare bones. And, you know, and these even professors, they make like $200,000 a year. It's insane. In New York City and another and San Francisco and other major cities, a lot of people aren't paying their rent. And this means that the property owners aren't going to pay property taxes. And this means that they're not going to have money for these schools. So, you know, the rental crisis is going to end up leading to, the public schooling crisis. They're not going to be able to fund public schools unless they just print money. So, you know, that could be the end of this. And I put an ad in my local paper. I haven't heard anybody, but I threw my email address in there. And I offered parents to, I would teach parents how to teach themselves. And then they would teach their kids how to teach themselves. And, you know, and that's how to do homeschooling. And I haven't gotten any takers yet, but, you know, I'm going to keep the ad in there because I think this is really the way to go. You know, when you homeschool your kid, you don't do it. You don't reproduce the schoolhouse. You train that kid to be as an independent of a learner as possible. Art Robinson did it that way, and it worked fantastically. It worked great because, you know, the kids know they might not like learning or they might not, you know, but they know the first thing in the morning, I got 2-3 hours of, you know, these math problems and some reading to do, and then whatever, go on. And but then they do that every day for, you know, 6 days a week for 10 years, and they're going to be way ahead. They're going to be like a bachelor of science level in you know, by the time they're 16, 17 years old, just from a couple hours every morning rather than all this time wasting at school. So this is really the trick to learning, is just teaching yourself. And if you need help training yourself to teach yourself, get in touch. I'll help you. It makes learning so much more fun and more effective, you know, and that would be a real revolution if we could persuade. It would be like the Gutenberg press invention. You know, when we learned we don't need, the reason they had school classrooms was because they didn't have a printing press. They didn't have, you know, they had to have this in person, you know, right on the board so that you could copy basically the books into your copy book, you know, and we don't need that anymore. We have printing presses. You know, there's obviously still some reason for in person, like, you know, dance instruction, music instruction, but as far as book learning and stuff, that really is something you can train yourself with books and pencil and paper. There's a great video on the internet, Math in the Soviet Union, and about how people who didn't have access to technology and computers were getting really good at math theory just using pencil and paper. Something like social cohesion in math. And, you know, they're kind of like going on about, well, the Jews were persecuted. They weren't allowed to Moscow University. But I mean, who cares about that? But what the point of it was when you're deprived of educational resources, sometimes that you learn even better because you're pissed off and motivated and you don't need all that fancy crap. So,
right. I mean, a lot of education is stuff that you can learn from books. The teachers are useful because, well, they can help explain the book to you when the book resists your knowledge. But you can find that kind of instruction on the web a great deal. This is why college education is increasingly overpriced, I think, because intelligent people who have the ability and the love of learning, the ability to teach themselves and the love of learning, they increasingly don't need this at all. And I, you know, years ago, I thought it was really gutsy when Peter Thiel started giving people scholarships not to go to college if they were really bright. Just skip it all, you know, start a business, teach yourself what you need to learn to start a business or, you know, be accomplished in one area or another. I think that's a very, very valuable thing. If I were 19 right now, I would not be thinking of going to college. If I were 19 right now and know basically the stuff about how the world works that I know today, I definitely would avoid college. I would go the route of creating my own business and educating myself in certain ways. I just think that one comes out with great advantages that way. First of all, your time isn't wasted. Your money isn't wasted either. And that gives you competitive advantages in the society. Again, the society that we've got requires a large number of mandarins, of educated people, and yet the entire ethos of the left is debauching all the standards so that these positions can't be filled. So there's a real need. And I think homeschooled people are definitely going to have a competitive advantage. They already do, and they will have it increasingly in the future. People who aren't hobbled by tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars of student loan debt are going to have competitive advantages. They already do, and these advantages are only going to increase in the future. Rob, we're running out of time. We're coming up on an hour. Do you want to just wrap this up with a few basic things and also recommendations for how people can follow your ideas, read more, etc.?
Yeah, unfortunately, my blog was deleted from WordPress. I've been canceled off the internet, so I don't even try anymore. But I wanted to mention before our hour is up that the best engineering field for teaching yourself is electrical engineering, and that incidentally is the most difficult one. But the branches of engineering: mechanical engineering, civil engineering, chemical engineering, environmental, and electrical. Well, you can't build a bridge in your backyard, you know. You know, for mechanical, you know, maybe that's not so easy to do the labs. But electrical engineering, you can get an inexpensive Elenco electronics laboratory and do all kinds of low voltage safe electrical engineering experiments where you learn the principles of electromagnetism inexpensively, safely, and quite reasonable, you know. And then if you say you want to do mechanical engineering, you will have learned all of the basics, all the math and the principles, because there's a lot of overlap in the engineering disciplines. So I'm teaching myself electrical engineering, and I do plan to go back to the University of Connecticut to major in electrical engineering when I've got the math done and have like an associate degree level of electrical engineering. So I would recommend, you know, if you're ambitious, teach yourself electrical engineering. I use the Cleveland Institute and Elenco Electronics Lab, you know, and get in touch with me if you want help doing this. Most people are unmotivated. You know, God knows, I give people math books, I offer to help them, and most people don't want to do anything. So if you're actually motivated to do stuff, you're going to be one of the few and one of the proud. Most people are just unmotivated. It's a shame. So I hope there's some listeners out there that want to stand above the crowd.
Yeah.
Come with me if you want to live.
Yeah, exactly. Another area where you really can educate yourself is anything connected with the internet or computer programming. And of course, that bleeds over into electrical engineering. There are a lot of self-taught millionaires and billionaires out there now in the world of tech. It's something that's conducive to people who teach themselves or who seek out apprenticeships, private, you know, relationships with people that they can learn from. So I do think that's really valuable advice. Yeah, I'm sorry you have been so deplatformed. And you always have a platform, though, at Countercurrents. Look up Kievsky's articles at Countercurrents. It's just Kievsky. The name will appear in the show notes when we repost this podcast in the coming week. And so just type his name into the search function and follow his stuff there. There's a lot of great advice. One thing that I think, and this came out of one of our earlier conversations, is that we have to start looking at America like immigrants look at America. And I don't mean immigrants like from Mexico. I mean immigrants from places like South Korea or India. High IQ immigrants. Let's be high IQ immigrants and figure out how we can hack our way into the American middle class, how we can work together, capitalize one another, help one another out. Because these people have very valid skills and they are inserting themselves straight off the boat into the middle class and the upper middle class, the property owning class, the employer class. And that gives them disproportionate power. Money is power in America. And I do think that if more of us just had that outsider mentality, and we already do, because if you're listening to me, if you're listening to Kievsky, we already believe that the system is no longer ours, that we're locked out of it. But at the same time, like these outside groups, we can figure out ways of hacking into it because it needs us, even though it discriminates against us. So there's just a lot of food for thought in our past podcasts and in Kievsky's articles. And, you know, I want all of us out there, all of our listeners, all of the people in our community to thrive. I think that's the most important thing we can do. Living well is the best revenge. And if we live well, we attract more people to our community and we make our community more capable of exerting power as the system declines around us. And we can actually feed on the decline of the system and become empowered by it. You know, no matter what kind of economic crisis you're in, there's always somebody who's making money, right? We need to be the kind of people who can position ourselves to profit from the system's decline.
Thank you very much for having me on, Greg.